Sitting opposite me is one of Australia's most distinguished journalists, Neil Chenoweth, who's an investigative business journalist with the Australian Fin Review and Murdoch biographer. I am, of course, the oldest surviving pundit in the Murdoch stable, so this will be an interesting experience for both of us. I survive, of course, as the licensed left-wing loony. And in that role, I commence this discussion about a very good thriller. And I love listening to thrillers whilst I drive to and from the farm each week. And this is a beauty. It's got all the ingredients. It's got pirates. It's got hackers. It's got covert operations. It's got threats and money. Lots of money being made and lost, and very intense rivalry. And there's even a mysterious death and an assassination attempt. Readers of The Fin will already know parts of it because it's a story that Neil Chenoweth's been following for some years now. His book is called Murdoch's Pirates. Joins me in the Sydney studio. G'day, Neil. I understand that this book, big and old as it is, was rather larger before it was energetically edited by others.
Yes, I did have this quite ambition to write myself to the moon and back, but thankfully Alan and Unwin did cut back some of my more florid qualities there.
So you're not unhappy with this reduced version?
No. I mean, look, it is. There's a whole range of people there, and telling their story takes some time, but I lived and breathed the world that these guys lived in, and there is a certain racy kind of quality to it.
Now, you wrote a business biography of Rupert Murdoch. You're not alone in that, are you? There's been a few others that have tackled the business side of his domain, of his personality.
Yes, I think there's a whole range of insomnia curing books. My book was a solid tome, and I think it would fare well in that range of solid. Not an easy read.
You came across something called NDS, which you describe as the most outlandish company you've ever come across. That's saying something.
It is, but it's just one of these bizarre companies. It's set up almost at a whim by Rupert Murdoch on the advice of a South Australian, Bruce Hundertmark, who had this particular vision that didn't make any sense until 6 months later, Rupert Murdoch decides to launch what becomes the BSkyB in Britain, and he needs this encryption process.
Why did he need the encryption process? Was it because anyone and everyone could get Sky for free without it?
Yes, he had this idea that he would launch Sky as this free-to-air service. But, of course, anyone that sells all the Hollywood studios then said, well, you can't just distribute our stuff for free. You have to have some way of encrypting it, of having a lock and a key that actually makes sure that your people have actually paid for it. But the guy that actually ran it for most of these early years was actually on the run. There was an arrest warrant out for him in the United States.
On the run for what?
Stock fraud. He had been fined in the United States. Actually, he's a man that actually seems to have who ripped off or defrauded almost everyone that he's come in contact with for longer than about half an hour. I mean,
and Rupert's antenna didn't sort of say, stay away from this bloke?
Not apparently. Well, I mean, there were some distractions at the time. There was the whole debt crisis that Rupert Murdoch was going through, and this guy sort of slips in, and he has to travel around Europe and the world on a false passport because, I mean, obviously, if you've got an arrest warrant right, for you when you're a News Corp executive, you do have to sort of be a little bit careful there.
Heavens above. So we're talking about the late 80s, aren't we? When
late 80s, early 90s, yes. And then it becomes a problem because they've gone to air with Sky with a fairly cheap system, and they found that everyone and his dog loves the program, and it's really easy to hack into it.
I can remember when Galaxy started here, and they're operating in the rural sector, morphed into Austar, which is now morphed as a part of Foxtel. There were people sort of selling, effectively Galaxy decoders in pubs. It can't have been that hard to work out how to uncrypt the encryption.
No, it and As time progressed, they had more and more complicated cards. But it's the way that the way piracy works is it gets a foothold. People get accustomed to watching it for free. There's a financial base. They're used to paying pirates to do this. The pirates have money to invest in the next wave of piracy products. So BSkyB was in major trouble from it when, in about 96, they decided to hire some heavy-duty security people.
Like Oliver Commerling.
Well, he was actually their biggest problem. He was the big German pirate who could crack all of their cards. They started off by hiring Scotland Yard commanders or US Army intelligence guys. The deputy head of Shin Bet, the internal Israeli security service.
Wow, this is heavy hitters.
And then they target the pirates, and they do it with some success. But, you know, at some stage, there's a beyond the fringe cartoon of two bears in a sniper scope, and the one with the way that the crosshairs is on is pointing to the other one and saying shoot him, and that's essentially part of what makes sense here is that if you've got a product that's being pirated, it's a lot easier if your competitor is pirated as well, and that's the area that the competition between these pay TV operators becomes problematic.
So it wasn't illegitimate for Murdoch to want to find secure encryption?
Not at all. And one of the things that he does then is, first of all, he targets the pirates. He hires Oliver Commerling. And then Oliver Commerling says, well, let me teach you how to do this.
This is the poacher as gamekeeper.
Absolutely.
Right.
So he sets up a black hat team in a laboratory in Haifa there. And at some stage, there's a decision is made to reverse engineer all of their cards that the competitors have. Now, why that decision is made is never quite clear. But through 1997, there's this elaborate, 1998, elaborate process where they obtain these cards and they use a focused ion beam in a laboratory in Bristol, and then they reverse engineer in Haifa. They travel to the United States repeatedly. They stay undercover. It's an entirely covert operation, but at the end of the day, they've reverse engineered all of their major competitors' cards.
And yet you describe Murdoch himself as something of a Luddite.
Yes, there's a great quote when he makes it clear that he's not really interested in the technology at all, as long as it does what he wants it to do. And yet, NDS has this strange attraction to him. I think Abe Peled tells him the war stories that Reuven Hassack passes on to him, and I think he's fascinated by Israel by itself.
Yeah. So it's like getting an Enigma machine at Bletchley Park. It's exciting, thrilling.
Yes, the idea that you can create the codes and break everyone else's codes.
Is it true that quite a lot of the people in and around NDS were, shall we say, interesting?
They were certainly colourful there. I mean, the Ray Adams, the head of operational security for England.
No relation.
He was either the most decorated policeman in modern history or the most controversial. He was the subject of a couple of corruption inquiries, from which he will tell you himself that he emerged completely unscathed there.
But he could have been scathed, in your view. He was close to scathing, was he?
I think there was a brief that went to the DPP, which found there was no grounds for charges to be laid.
Okay, did Rupert have a deniability about NDS?
Well, part of what happens with NDS is having obtained everyone else's secrets, these secrets end up appearing on piracy websites around the world.
In other words, there were no secrets about the secrets.
No. And if you look at some of the digital records, it's almost certain that the files that were placed on these piracy websites had originally come from the Black Hat lab in Haifa there.
You know, he would have been better off hiring the young Julian Assange. I mean, that's how I met Julian on this program, because he was a brilliant young hacker, as you know.
And that's the thing about hacking. The moment that Julian Assange appears on the scene, you end up with security people called in to handle him.
Yes,
you've got major intelligence agencies, major police work. And the thing is, corporations react the same way. When they're faced by hackers, they reach for the same people, the same skill set. But it changes the culture of that corporation.
I knew Kerry Packer very, very well. And Kerry had a huge problem with gambling, as you know. But as he always said, I never gamble with the company. Rupert, on the other hand, doesn't approve of gambling. But boy, he bets double or nothing. He's gambled with the company again and again. And as you and I both know, towards the end of 2002, News Corp was in as big a mess as it was possible for a multi-billion-dollar corporation to be in. What caused that? How did that happen?
Sorry, 2002, or you mean...
I'm sorry. 1991. Yeah, I'm sorry. Got the year wrong, but you know that. Not the
event.
He had...
He has this habit of making these colossal gambles. It's as if he's attracted to being on the absolute brink of disaster. When he can pull it off, he has this fantastic survival sense. But I have to say, he hasn't been doing that for the last 15 years or so. And, you know, if you're looking at Rupert Murdoch's his history, one of the interesting things for me is, if you remember Bruce Dover's book about Rupert Murdoch in China.
We discussed it on the program, yeah.
That he's in Hong Kong for the handover, and he gets completely lost in the crowd for three hours, and he's just bedraggled and sweaty and everything else. And he emerges, and he's elated. He's exhilarated by the vibrancy of what he's met there. And actually, that's actually the day before he's met Wendy Deng there. But it's...
I was there that night. I was pissing down. It was a remarkable night, by any measure, yeah.
It's like, it was one of those kind of turning points for Rupert Murdoch. He goes in a different direction from that point. I'm not saying that there's any particular reason for it, but the gambles have been under control, but also the skeletons in the cupboard have begun to emerge.
But again and again, you know, he does in fact gamble the company, and every time thus far he's been just at the brink of the abyss. He pulls it off, doesn't he?
He certainly has. He's one of the world's great survivors there. And I suppose that's why there are a bunch of people that have lost their bets when they bet against Rupert Murdoch's survival instinct.
Well, what did he get out of this association with NDS? You know, at the end of the day, what did it do for him?
Well, for one... I mean, he got a great deal of cash for it. He sold it for $5 billion this year. So it's an enormous amount of profit that he's made. But more than that, it shaped that whole vision of him to create this worldwide global satellite platform. And because the encryption card is the bit that controls it, it's the bit that manages your database. It gives you the...
It was, in effect, the first smart card, in a way, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it was the first... Bruce Hindmarck's great genius was to think this smart card can be used exactly for this... you just put it into your set-top box, to your Foxtel box, and it does it all for you there.
Who bought NDS for this vast amount of money?
Cisco. The deal was completed, I think, about August 31st.
Cisco being?
A major electronic router, a whole bunch of stuff.
A competitor of Rupert's or someone?
Not at all. I mean, it's Cisco will have is into telecommunications infrastructure rather than producing content.
Of course, when satellites started off in Australia, it was in fact a very sluggish beginning, and it was a pretty hard row, wasn't it, for everyone who went into it. Galaxy, for example, went belly up.
Yes, and as you said, because there were so many cards and set-top boxes.
Is that one of the reasons that they got into financial trouble, that people could view without... paying up?
That was certainly one of the major issues. I talked to Michael Boulos, who ran Tarbes, and he's convinced that if it hadn't been for piracy, his ethnic pay TV operation would still be there. It's the difference between that extra bit of profit that makes your operation actually work and having that income just sort of sucked out.
So how big these days is Rupert's satellite operation around the world? It's big here, we know that. It's pretty big in the US.
He's had to sell out of DirecTV, and so that's a major sort of blank for him. He controls Sky B, he controls Sky Deutschland, he controls Sky Italia, Star
TV. What happened in China? That got a bit problematic, didn't it?
Yes, there is this eternal hope, I think, that he has of being able to make it there. He, in 1993, I don't know if you recall, he makes a speech where he talks about technology overwhelming the communist governments of the world.
He got in a bit of trouble.
Yes,
and Beijing
just
didn't
jump
like
over
that.
The hurdles that they have and go directly to their people, which went down really, really badly.
But for a Luddite, he's always been very prescient. I remember having to explain to Kerry Packer in words of one syllable what a satellite could bloody well do, while Rupert, you know, picks up the traces and goes for it.
Absolutely. He can come up with this idea, but it has to be an idea that makes sense. Like, for instance, in the late 1980s, Britain was looking to have a high definition, a digital pay TV service, and he'd licensed it. But Rupert Murdoch went ahead with a low tech PAL system, and as a result, Britain had a PAL system, an old fashioned PAL system, for the next 10 years' time. He locked them into that earlier technology.
What happened to the members of the shadowy members of the NDS team?
They're still around. One of the really interesting things was about in 2008, there was a fairly high-profile trial where one of the largest satellite companies in the world was suing NDS for essentially industrial espionage.
Knocking off their secrets.
Yes.
Yeah.
NDS essentially won that. I mean, EchoStar won damages of about a couple of hundred bucks and had to pay something like $19 million of legal costs.
But, Neil, can the law, an international law such as it is, keep up with the rapidity of technical change here?
One of the problems is that if you're running a pay TV operation, suddenly you realise that you're making much less money than you expected. It takes you a year or two to work out that you've got a piracy problem, and then to work out what that problem is, and then if you're lucky, you can find out who's causing that. Now, by the time you've actually worked out, perhaps you suspect it might be a competitor such as NDS.
Oh, I see.
By that stage, it's 4 years down the track. You're beyond the statute of limitations. You can't do a thing about it. And that's one of the issues that they've been sued by about five major corporations, all of them alleging pretty much the same thing. And they've emerged from it untouched and unsullied. But you have to wonder why so many corporations have essentially brought the same allegation against News Corporation's arm here.
And of course, when you made these allegations in the Fin, or started to make them, you were energetically rebuffed by News Limited. Surprise.
Well, they certainly took a. There were two aspects to the response. One of them, I should say, I ended up with this batch of about 15,000 emails that Ray Adams, this former
no relation again,
English commander from Scotland Yard, had. He worked for them, and I end up with this sort of slice of life from him, where these guys on the hand are talking together. They're doing these basically planning what seems to be pretty appalling things to me. On the other hand, you've got these jocks competing together and elbowing each other. You've also got some pretty colourful private life and also...
Weren't you walking through a minefield yourself doing...
It was there, but I mean, it's like. But what I'm trying to say is, though, that there's a whole. It's just a slice of life. There's a whole mundane element. It's like someone picking up your email, and there's a whole bunch of different lives to it. But it's the story of the people that I found fascinating, whether they're the hackers being pursued or the people pursuing them. There's a really interesting human story that kind of interweaves it.
So it's not just a Murdoch story, it's a story with a big cast of characters.
Yes, yes. Now, when the first court case came out, there was a whole PR strategy that News Corp came out with, and you could see it then falling out this year. It was the same strategy where you'd have... Someone said, well, look, we'll have Chase Carey or Rupert Murdoch make a statement, and then we will deny it all, and then we won't say anything at all, which is essentially what would happen there. But and then there's a second part of that, which if you look at the way that they reacted to the phone hacking stuff in the case in the UK, was the on the front foot, using your newspapers to rebut as robustly as you possibly can.
Well, it's a story of bewildering complexity, and I thank you for trying to explain it to an ageing Luddite. And the book, Murdoch's Pirates, before the phone hacking there was Rupert's pay TV skullduggery, and I guess you've sent an autograph copy to to one of my employers.
Sure, do we have that?
Thanks, Neil. Veteran investigative journalist Neil Chenoweth writes for the Fin, and his book Murdoch's Pirates is published by Allen and Unwin. And this is Alan L on RN, I should mention that. And coming up, a reunion with Ramona Cavall.